Let's have an AA meeting.
Let's have one.
My name is Cecilia, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This is a reading based on the passage from page 29 in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our own personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Please let's welcome Lisa from the Triangle 7:30 early morning, early bird group. Let's give her a good NABA welcome.
My name is Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic. I was texting with friends of mine earlier today, and I was so nervous because life has really been crazy in the past couple of years. And I talked to my sponsor today, and I just got quiet, and I got settled. And I remember that the singleness of purpose, you know, is to carry the message. And the only thing, I can't screw this up because it's only my experience, strength, and hope. So as I prayed before I got here and I prayed when I got here, I asked my higher power that I choose to call God to help me carry the message to the best of my ability. And so that's what I'm gonna do today. The old timers taught me through their example just to lead by example. And you know, today I try to be an example, maybe not a shining example rather than a dire warning, because I was a dire warning when I got here. And I've said it in my women's meetings a lot. You know, when I got here, I was a combination, well, there's a lot of young people here, so you probably wouldn't know, Joan Jett, David Lee Roth, and I tried to be a little Pat Benatar, but it just didn't work out. And I was in all black. Not much of that has changed, but I did wear color tonight. So anyways, I'm just going to do a little qualifying. And I was smiling when I came in here because I, you know, for me, I mean, I needed to stick close in the beginning, and I still do. And it's you guys that showed me how to go out in life and live life on life's terms. And the lights remind me of AA dances because I went to every AA dance. And I became like Julie McCoy, like organizing the whole thing. I had to call my friends, like, what are you wearing? It was just, yeah, it sounds like a really geek thing to do, but I was one of them, you know. Anyway, so my sobriety date is July 3rd, 1989. I moved to Atlanta in 1988. I came down here. I'm from Baltimore. I'm an East Coast girl. And I basically was forced to move down here because I had burned all my bridges in Baltimore. I drank and used my way into the very bottom. And I'm all about the singleness of purpose, but if I'm going to practice my first step, honestly, the principle behind the first step is that there are other chemicals in my story. I'm just putting that out there. I'm not going into that. I'm not going to tell you about the eight balls of cocaine and all that like I just did. But anyways, that's a whole nother story. But anyway, so I moved down here, and being from the East Coast, I thought I basically had come to hell when I got down here because East Coast to me was more like cosmopolitan, and I got down here and I didn't know that there was a lake like Lake Lanier. And in Brookhaven or that area, there was a building with a sailboat on the top of it. And I couldn't figure out. I thought, why are these people so backwards? There's a sailboat and there's no water around here. I couldn't figure it out. But just to give you a little example, my way of coping in an alcoholic family was sarcasm and humor. And underneath that sarcasm and humor was deep pain. And I hated Atlanta because I hated myself, and I hated, for me to this day, the first day I got sober, I didn't think alcohol and drugs were my problem, because everybody around me drank and used at the same level. I just took it up a notch. And so we moved down here in 1988. My dad was transferred down here, and I didn't have a choice but to move down here with family of origin. Luckily, they didn't kick me out on the street as they should have, and I still had a job, but I basically drank and used around the clock. And just a little backstory, I did a lot of geographic cures before I came to Atlanta. I grew up in a very alcoholic home, and I do believe that this is a disease. I do believe it's a genetic disease. My dad was a workaholic, the alcoholic, and he would come home, and he would smell like, working late. He'd come in and kiss us goodnight on the head, and I could smell what I thought was like evergreen. Fast forward years later, that became my drink, which was Tanqueray and tonic. But at the end, I couldn't afford any of that. And so... I got a job here, but I had, when I moved to Atlanta, I had about $100 to my name. I mean, that was it. And I got a job, and I ended up hooking up with some of the people that I had known in one of my former geographic other cures, was to move where my mom was from when she was from Louisiana. My mom was from a family of nine in Louisiana. My dad's from northern Minnesota, so it was like two opposite ends of the world coming together, but they met in California. And I am the middle screwed-up child in the family. I have two elder sisters and a younger brother, and I had a resentment probably my whole life because I was born practically in a snowbank, and they got to say that they were California girls, like the Beach Boys, you know, California girls. And but in all seriousness, there was just a lot of chaos in my childhood. We didn't grow up with money. My dad just worked hard. We lived in little suburbia back in the day when things were a little safer. I could walk to school, and it wasn't like don't leave your house kind of thing. You walk to school. But my sisters, got involved in, you know, that 70s kind of thing, and they were 10 and 9 years older than me. So I was always looking ahead to be somebody else than I was, and I wanted to be just like them. And so there was a lot of furniture being thrown, a lot of people were being beaten up in my household, and I was told, if you turn out like your sisters, you're going to be just kicked out. So what I did is I learned to internalize things and not talk about, you know, I just internalized. And so when they took me out of public school, even though they couldn't afford it, they put my brother and I in private, thinking that would, like, fix us, you know. Like, if they do this, then we won't do that. And it just kind of the polar opposite happened. First of all, I hated having to wear a uniform. That was, like, the worst thing in the world, because that was a death sentence, and I wanted to plan my outfits and all this kind of stuff. So, but I was the one that, you know, it just so happened I would find the people that were on the edges or the fringes or whatever. And one of my best friends, she had older sisters, and I can remember when my dad would come home from work drinking, having been drinking, I wanted to escape. And so I met some kids that were older, and they introduced us to some things that you smoked on the beach, and I thought they were cigarettes, and I was 10 and a half when I smoked those things. But I was doing those drinking things at that same age, at 10 and a half years old. And at that time, I started going into my dad's liquor cabinet, and I learned it. I mean, I didn't know it. Other people did it when I heard their story, is that they said, oh, they went into their parents' liquor cabinet and they added water to the alcohol or whatever. So, and I think my dad drank more because he's like, couldn't figure out why it was so weak when he kept drinking, because I was drinking it. So, but I grew up with tremendous insecurity, and that's probably why I'm so nervous tonight, is I stuttered severely as a child, and severe dyslexia, and there's a part of that that is still there. And, long before there was that term in the news of bullying and stuff like that, I had a lot of that. And because of some of the people my sister was around, my eldest sister was killed in a car accident when I was 11 and a half by a drunk driver. And I was at a private girls' school, and my dad had worked very hard in corporate world and became affiliated with the school. And people, I just remember how uncomfortable that was when people were talking about me behind my back and who my sister had been married to and all this kind of stuff. And so the way I coped is I just drank and I did drugs, and then I also got up and did sit-ups in the morning just because I wanted to work out and be skinny, even in the sixth grade. And so, so like I said, in the beginning of, you know, in my life, in my family, sarcasm and you know, just being sarcastic was a way of coping. My mom was, and I've lovingly referred to my mom, even in sobriety, as Joan Crawford. There's a lot of people in here that don't even know who that is. And I, her name is not Joan, but I've referred to her as Joan my whole life, basically. But because of the program, because of the steps, because of the traditions, because of the concepts, because of the big book, because of you guys as my example, and because of Al-Anon, thank you very much, I can say today that there's a lot of life on life's terms going on right now, but I care for my parents. And I realize that there's a lot of dysfunction that is untreated alcoholism. And the only program I can work is my own. I've idolized my dad my whole life. He was an only child. He was a workaholic. And he's just been my example. But the chaos in my childhood with all the craziness and the drinking and throwing and everything. So when a job happened of change, my dad had to be transferred down to Atlanta. And that was the worst thing for me in the world because my whole world was in Baltimore. My whole life was in Baltimore. I grew up in Baltimore. We moved there when I was 4. I was actually born, I'm a St. Pauli girl. I was originally a St. Pauli girl from Minnesota. But my dad had to be transferred down here. So for that whole year in 1988 until 1989, I just did anything and everything. But when I graduated from high school, it was a college prep school. I was forced to go to like college because it was college prep. I went to Virginia. I went to school there out of state. But for me, it was just an excuse to drink and do drugs. Whoever was the bad crowd, I never went to class. I failed out of school. I was gold star on the AP every semester. And if you don't know what AP, it's academic probation from the day I was there. And so I just kind of, you know, skated my way through that. Then I was forced to move back to Baltimore because my parents threatened me and said, you know, if you can't, you know, you got to come home. So I had to go home and go to local school and drank my way, got into trouble all the time. Finally, I said, okay, well, I'm going to move to Louisiana, and I did another geographic, and that's where my mom is from. Well, I got into a crowd down there, and these people really drank and did drugs hard, really drank. And I did attend some classes, but I also was like a big fish in a small pond kind of thing, but I really wasn't. It's just because I spoke differently being from East Coast and I was in Louisiana. And I had a car that said Maryland tags instead of Louisiana, so I stuck out like a sore thumb. So when the cops would pull me over at nighttime because of that, and it probably had something to do with what I was dressed in at the time, like the 80s and the hair and the, I got my way out of it. And so, but I really, my alcoholism and drug addiction really took me to another level. And the people that I hung out with were some pretty big drug cartels. And I didn't know to the degree of that, but there was some friends of mine that we hung out with. And back then, there wasn't anything like these after-hours places. There are places like you bring your own alcohol and stuff like that. Well, this one girl had broken up with one of the guys that was like the big guy. And I went to a friend of mine's house. We were all going to go drinking there until, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning. And she called the house and she said, hey, Lisa, you need to bring so-and-so and your so-and-so and so-and-so. You guys come over to this after party. And normally I would be, of course, yeah, let's go. And, I mean, at this time I had also become a drug dealer. And I know it's single enough as a purpose, but I can't just say I owned a liquor store because that's not the truth. I was a drug dealer. So I said, you know, let's not go. There's something in me that said, let's not go. And so the next morning when I went home, I turned on my little TV, and on the local news down there, there was 25 of my friends handcuffed with the FBI, and they all went to jail for like 25 to 30 years. And when I got sober, I heard people say, you know, think about those little God shots before you got sober. Think about those God shots where, you know, your God is your understanding was really there and you just didn't know it. And I know without a shadow of a doubt that my journey in sobriety has been divinely inspired. So I look back, and that was clearly God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I ended up moving back to Baltimore. Then we got to Atlanta. You know, I drank and used for a year. And just to give you a kind of a fast forward to stay out of a drunkalogue, I did meet some friends here. We went out of town on to another state to a resort, and I've never mentioned the place. I've never been back to the place, nor will I ever. I know we have the saying, you know, do not regret the past, no one should shut the door, and I just don't care to go back there. So we went there, and it was 24/7 drinking and using and never sleeping and never eating and never anything. And I was about probably 95 pounds soaking wet at the time. And it was a constant. So not to go into any major details, there was, you know, there was cops, there was blood, there was an ambulance, there was jail, there was, you know, hospital jail, there was all kinds of stuff. And called my parents in Atlanta, and they said, oh, you know, come home, we'll make you a nice dinner and everything's fine. So that's kind of the way my family operated, like don't talk about things and make sure to make it look good when you walk out the front door. Don't let anybody know what's going on behind closed doors. So for me in sobriety, starting to go through the steps in the first, second, and third, it's the fourth and fifth step in that freedom, the freedom that gave me the permission to let those walls down, to go and do the work and take away those fears and to try and carry that to somebody else. And so when I hit that bottom, came back to Atlanta, I had seen something like that my parents had me see some kind of thing. I guess it would have been kind of like a life coach or something. And we called him and he said, you know, you really need to get some help, Lisa. So we called, I don't know, friends of ours, doctor or whatever, and they said, well, you need to call Emory. And so they had us call Emory, and I had to see this doctor over there in the psychology section. And to this day, I can say his name. I mean, he's not in the program, so I can break his anonymity. His name is Dr. Stephen Cohen Cole, and I can still see his face today. And I went there with my mom, and they escorted us into a room. And, I mean, I had bandages on and all over my arm and all kinds of stuff. And they took us into a room and sat down, and then she started going off about what a horrible this, that, and the other thing, and he picked up his phone, and then the nurse came in from, like, the secret door. And, I mean, it was like out of a movie, you know, like the nurse in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest with the white cap and the white dress and the white shoes. They weren't coming to get me, she came in and asked Mrs. So-and-so, meaning my mom, to go outside, and the doctor said, shut the door, and he said to me, Lisa, can you tell me what's going on? How are you feeling? And I sat straight, I hadn't spoken or said anything, and for my whole life up to that point, alcohol and drugs were my way of coping because nobody in my family talked about the truth. Nobody talked about what was going on. Nobody talked about the reality of anything. And that my dad was drinking. My mom was from an alcoholic family. I mean, you know, my sister was killed by a drunk driver. Nobody talked about what the real issues were. And I sat up on the chair and I looked at the doctor straight and I said, listen, I'll tell you anything that you want to hear, but I'm going to tell you my truth. And I said, I've been living in prison my whole life, but today I feel like I'm in freedom. And he said, you have two choices. You can either go to like a 30-day treatment center or you can go to AA. And I said, listen, I'll go to 150 meetings a day, but I'm not going to any building that's going to shut the door and might take the keys and lock up behind me, because I've been locked in prison my whole life. So went home and called the AA Central office, and there was a gentleman that answered the phone, and I called, but I was scared, so I handed it to my mom, and she started telling him about what a bad person I was, and he said, listen, I need to talk to the person that's that wants to get off alcohol. Got me back on the phone, and he said, and, you know, we were just a year into Atlanta. I mean, this was not in a time during, like, GPS. You didn't get a cell phone to, like, find out wherever it was. And he said, do you know where the Tower Liquor Store is? And I said, well, hell, I know where every other liquor store is. Why don't I know where that one is? And he said, well, okay. So I had the paper out. I was writing the directions down. But I want to go back a second before I get to that one ending piece is I didn't know what an alcoholic was before I got sober. I didn't know. The only reference I had was there was a friend of mine in school that was in my class, and her mom came to pick her up at, you know, at the end of the day, and she was dressed in, like, full-on Chanel and, like, all together, and I was like, that's an alcoholic? I'm going to grow up and be just like her. And then, like, in the seventh grade, we had, like, social studies class or something, and the teacher thought it would be a good idea to get these speakers to come talk to us, and so this lady came to come to the class. She was all dressed up, really nice. And, you know, it's girls' school. So the teacher said, you know, here's a chair for you. Well, the lady said, no, I don't want to sit in the chair. So she comes around the desk. She plops on the desk right there. I was like, this lady's cool. I got to hear what she's got to say. And she said, my name is so-and-so. I'm an alcoholic. And I was just enthralled. And I was in the seventh grade. So fast forward, before I get to the end of my story, to what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, just some of the privileges and what the byproduct of sobriety is for me is that service work has saved my life in sobriety. It has literally saved my life. And I my home group was the 545 at Triangle. Triangle's my home. Triangle's where I got sober. I'll get into that in a second. And then I met some young people, and then Skyland was my home group for 12 years. And I got really involved in service work. And I, at one point, was it's the PICPC person, the person in cooperation with the professional community. So I got to go and, like, do what that lady did in the seventh grade when I got to see her. And that's, like, a full circle moment for me because there's a sense of dignity. And and the things that I've gotten to do in sobriety are pretty amazing, but just to go back real quick to my end, and then I'll get you to the byproducts of sobriety. But so I found the Tower Liquor Store, and the guy told me on the phone, he said, when you turn into Lakeshore Drive, there is a massage therapy place on the left-hand side. And I thought, okay, great. But before that, before planning to get to the meeting, I'd gone into my dad's hunting closet, and I'd gotten my dad's camouflage hunting pants, and a red and blue flannel shirt and a T-shirt that I wore underneath. And it was like 99 degrees out, you know, it's July. And I was trying to look like an alcoholic looked when I got to the AA meeting. And so, you know, nothing matched. And to me, to this day, people know me, everything matches, even underneath matches. So, nothing matched. But I can remember when I got to the driveway, and I parked my car really, really far away at Triangle, and I didn't look at, I got out of the car, I looked at the ground, I did not look up at anyone. I could have counted and told you how many rocks are on the ground before I got, and it was just a little tiny white house, the stairs, and people, here it is in the dead of summer, like 150 degrees outside, it felt like. People were outside smoking and drinking coffee, and I'm like, where have I landed? How am I here? And people are drinking coffee in the middle of the summertime. And I walked up the stairs, went up to the room, took a hard right, went into the very back corner. And I would say there was about 15 people in that meeting. But I looked down, and it wasn't until I went through the big book the first time that the only two words that can be described from what I felt was incomprehensible demoralization. That was it. And I never looked up until about halfway through the meeting, And everybody in that meeting, the chair that night, I heard what I needed to hear. It's like they were sharing with me what had been going on in my head for a long time. Not that I thought that I was an alcoholic drug addict, but I could relate. And it's almost like they gave me permission to authenticate what I was feeling. And so I think when somebody says, you know, what's your takeaway from your first meeting, it's always, I tell people, it's always keep coming back. Nobody said you have to have the big book memorized by the time you come to the next meeting and there's going to be a test. You know, there's going to be a test and you're going to have to tell us every name of the person, people that are in the next meeting, and you're going to have to say it backwards at the end of the meeting, too. So nobody said that to me. And nobody said, you can't wear your camouflage pants and your flannel shirt. Nobody said that to me. Nobody said, you have to have a Louis Vuitton. I don't think it existed then. But anyways, nobody said you had to have a Louis Vuitton purse when you come into the AA meeting. Nobody said you have to live in this certain zip code. Or that you even have to come into an A meeting with your shoes matching. Nobody said that. You can come in, half your head can be green, half of it can be orange. You can have 10 nose piercings. You can do whatever you want. You don't have to have an education. You don't have anything. You can stutter, and it doesn't matter. Nobody said that. And for the first time in my life, I felt at home. And just to highlight some of the privileges of sobriety and doing the work, I 100% believe in sponsorship. I 100% believe in the big book. I 100% believe in meeting makers make it. I 100% believe in service work is the way that to survive and live and win. And the sponsor I have today is truly an angel in my life. She's my sponsor of 24 years. And not only is she my sponsor, but she's family. And I've been a part of her family for a very, very long time, and she's surviving cancer, and she's literally my North Star and an example and walks the walk of this program. And if I could be so lucky to do one 100,000th of what she's done for me in my life, then it would be a privilege to help somebody else. I got involved with ITIPAM when I first got sober, the International Conference of Young People in AA. We were able to bring the convention here in 1992. We had 4,500 people come and show up, and it was amazing. 1995, I got to go to the International Conference in San Diego. And no matter what you believe in or believe and don't believe in, to be in the football stadium there at the end of the meeting holding hands with 60,000 people saying the Lord's Prayer, I was levitating by the time I left there. And that sounds so cliche, but not to me. It was amazing. And the people I was holding hands with were from every other world and country and everything, but we all had one language. It was language of the heart and of the program. And I've been able to travel outside of the United States and go to international meetings where they were not English-speaking meetings, and it didn't matter because we all spoke the same language. You could look in the people's eyes. And when I first went to those first things sober, you know, like I said, AA dances or going to a wedding or going to a funeral. And, life has hit hard in the past few years. We all have a story. I can't speak for anybody else. I can speak for myself that I would say it's some of the hardest couple years of my life. In the past few years, I've had four friends of mine die of this disease, two by suicide, two by ODing, and a year ago, 4 days ago, my cousin was a victim of the fentanyl crisis. And then somebody that I was very serious with at one point, I found out a year ago that he committed suicide. But these are all people also that got away from the program. And the people that I've known that have come back, I ask, you know, what are the things you stopped doing? They stopped going to meetings and they stopped praying. And for me, the other thing, too, that I'm adamant about because I have a really hard time doing it, it's asking for help. And I heard when I got sober, if I'm thinking about it, I better be talking about it because that disease, my disease is out there, like you guys have all heard, doing push-ups in the parking lot. And I don't want to. I still want to be on this side of the grave. And there's been times in the past couple of years I have not wanted to be on that side of this side of the grave. I got diagnosed with a really serious thing a few years ago, and I have to be in the cancer center twice a month getting infusions. And there's no cure for it. And my mom got diagnosed with cancer 2 years ago. Breast cancer, and December 20th, 2020, my sponsor's husband died just out of the blue. And his AA birthday was three days after mine. And, you know, it talks in the big book that you'll meet the family and the friends that you never thought you could imagine, and that we are not a glum lot, and that we are people that may not have mixed before. And I'm just so grateful to be here tonight. And, you know, there's one thing that I have to remember is that it's a we program. I don't have to do this by myself. And it doesn't have to be glamorous. There can be some days that are just all you're doing is just picking yourself up and coming in, suiting up and showing up. And there's a little lady that took me under her arms when I got sober. Her name was CCC. And she was my grand sponsor. And she dressed in Chanel from head to toe. There you go again. And she took me under her wing and she said, you know, you got to suit up and show up. And you got to act and look the way you want to look. You don't have to, you know, carry those same things that you had from before. And God knows I've done so many things in sobriety that probably wouldn't be approved by other people, but I have always put my sobriety first. And I've always found any arena that I can carry the message to somebody else. But I'm also very protective of my anonymity because it's been broken, not with my permission. And I'm a big believer in the traditions, and I'm a big believer in the concepts, and that everybody deserves an open door. And I'm no greater than anybody else. The only reason I'm sober today is because it's 124 hours at a time. Thank God we have one day at a time. Because I don't know if I could handle anything else in this life on life's terms stuff right now. But I heard a quote from somebody in the rooms, and it said, today is the tomorrow you were so worried about yesterday. And there are women in this room that are friends of mine that have walked through things and have walked through things that I've never walked through. And then I'm walking through the yets that I was terrified of. And I'm only doing it because of my tribe. And so there was a lady that I was really good friends with her, and her entire family was in the program at Skyland. And I just want to leave you with the one thing that she always closed the meeting out with, and this is what I always do. And to me, it's really important, and it just kind of engulfs the whole program. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happiness. May God bless you and keep you until then. It's been a privilege to let me be of service with you guys tonight. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you, Lisa. That was powerful. We're so glad that you were able to make it here to Tanava.
sleep, it'll never leave if I can.